Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, fj@offbeatoregon.com, your host for today's Offbeat Oregon History Podcast episode. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy it. Welcome to part two of this two-part presentation of the story of Imperial Japanese Navy submarine I-25. Yesterday in part one, we had just gotten to the part where the I-25 was following a bunch of fish boats toward Astoria and getting ready to open fire on Fort Stevens. Let's talk about what happened when they did. When the sub got within range, Tagami brought the sub to the surface with its bow pointed seaward so that it could scramble away to safety if things got sticky. Sailors scrambled out and got ready for action. The deck gun was deployed and limbered up and prepared for action. And then, wasting no time, because a submarine on the surface is like the most sinkable ship on the sea, not to mention the least survivable, they cut loose. And for the first time ever, the state of Oregon was under direct attack by a wartime enemy. We got off 17 rapid rounds of 5.5-inch shells from our deck gun and then raced out of there as fast as we could, leaving a wake of frantic fishermen, recalled Warrant Officer Nobuo Fujita, the sub's seaplane pilot, in an interview with the U.S. Navy's Joseph D. Darrington in 1961. I'm pretty sure he was joking about the frantic fishermen. The shooting started around midnight, by which time the fishermen would certainly have long since crossed the bar and headed for their home ports. On the shore, frantic was also a pretty good word to describe the effects of the cannon fire. Frantic, that is, to get to the gun emplacements and return fire before the shooting stopped. Soldiers and officers leaped out of bed and started running around trying to get ready and go help return fire, in the dark, of course. People tripped over stoves and crashed into trucks and cursed at one another as they scrambled into battle stations in their underwear. "We looked like hell," Captain Jack R. Wood, commander of the battery, told her story in Burt Weber later, "but we were ready to shoot back in a couple of minutes." They were ready and itching to scratch their trigger fingers lighting up the sea around the enemy sub, but the orders were to hold their fire. This was for several reasons. First, struggling to use his rangefinder on a handful of muzzle flashes across the dark ocean, Captain Wood concluded that the ship was out of their range. The big 10-inch guns, designed to stop ships from coming into the Columbia, would not tilt up high enough to lob shells to the attacking submarine. These guns dated from the Endicott era, roughly 1885 to 1905, and had been designed to fire black powder rounds. They were simply obsolete. The 12-inch mortars couldn't reach it either, or so they believed. Nonetheless, Wood requested permission to open fire. Major Robert Huston denied permission. Years later, he explained why in a letter to historian Weber.
"I refused permission on this basis," Huston wrote. "One, the submarine was not in range and was very likely firing a reconnaissance mission to spot the location of our batteries. Two, the submarine outranged us by about 4,000 yards, being a modern 5-inch, approximately, gun on a barbette carriage. Three, we had no radar at the time and had to depend on visual observation of the flashes or use searchlights, which certainly wasn't advisable when you are outranged and the target is out of range."
As it happened, the target was not out of range, although it wouldn't have taken the I-25 long to scoot back far enough to be safe. Playing a what-if game, though, if Fort Stevens had opened up with everything they had, all at once, aiming for the muzzle flashes, they would have had a pretty decent chance of blowing the sub out of the sea with the first or second salvo. For one thing, it would have been a huge surprise to the submariners to see the south bank of the river lighting up with cannon fire. Working with an old 1920s vintage chart, Captain Tagami believed that the defensive works along the river were on the north side, well out of range of his boat. He also believed that he was shelling a submarine base, not a full-on shore battery. When historian Weber actually met him in person more than 30 years later and showed him charts and pictures of the installations he'd been shelling that night, Tagami told him,
"I feel more than lucky to be here tonight. I had no idea there was such a big cannon right in front of me."
But hindsight, of course, is always very clear, and the idea of a submarine cutting loose with a single, puny, 5.5-inch gun in the dark of night made very little tactical sense unless it was on a reconnaissance mission. Shooting back might have made the crews feel better, but unless they got lucky with the first or second salvo, it would have revealed the gun's position and relative size and range to a submarine that they were pretty sure was on a mission to acquire exactly that information. If so, the minute all the guns opened up, the sub would race away out of range, then go home and report that a nice big fleet of surface warships sitting 10 miles out to sea with 10, 12, 16-inch guns could pound Fort Stevens with impunity from well out of range and then sail right up the Columbia River if it wanted to. Obviously, that couldn't be allowed to happen. So Fort Stevens sat there simmering with collective frustration and took it, all 17 shells, without so much as a pistol shot in reply. And eventually the I-25's crew got tired of shelling the dark and unresponsive mainland, put the gun away, and left. Behind they left the smoking wreckage of a baseball diamond backstop, some slightly damaged power lines, and a handful of holes in the ground. The total dollar value of damage done was probably well under $20. On its next visit to Oregon, the I-25 did better, if better is the right word. It started out on September 9th by launching its onboard seaplane with a couple incendiary bombs and orders to use them to start a forest fire near Brookings. It was the only wartime airstrike ever delivered on the American mainland before or since, but that's a story for another time. Key sources in this story included Silent Siege, a book by Burt Weber, 1984, Yigalian Press, Bombs Over Brookings, a book by William McCash, 2005, Maverick Press, and an article by Nobu Fujita and Joseph D. Harrington, published in June 1961 issue of U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Offbeat Oregon, by the way, is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. In addition to Offbeat Oregon books, podcasts, and audiobooks, we also publish book and audiobook versions of collections of what you might call street literature. 1920s pulp magazine writers like H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Rice Burroughs, gothic penny dreadful titles like Sweeney Todd and The Adventures of Highwayman Dick Turpin, all straight shots of bottled-in bond working man's fiction and working women's fiction from the last couple of centuries. If that sounds like your jam, I'd love to have you check them out. That is pulp-lit.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.